The Flint lead crisis is not new, but the ramifications of what happened or what didn't happen could resonate for generations, in a bad way. 19 months later, the government has agreed to replace lead service lines and institute a transparent and effective lead monitoring system, but the costs are enormous and Flint residents remain vigilant and distrustful. A new documentary will air on PBS this week about the science of the crisis and the bad science that was employed to dispute claims that something was wrong with the water. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we'll talk about lead abatement issues when it comes to paint in old homes and how state lawmakers want to ban local ordinances on that issue. Joining us now is the producer, writer, and director of NOVA, Poisoned Water, Llewellyn Smith. Welcome to the show. Hello, Lou? Okay, looks like we've lost Lou. We'll try to figure that one out. In the meantime, if you have a question or a comment. Oh, Lou, are you there?
Hello. Yes, I am.
Okay, sorry about that. How did the government employ bad science to refute claims about the bad water?
Well, what was happening in Flint as we began to look at the story is that the agencies that were responsible for monitoring the water and keeping it safe were using faulty testing protocols. And their testing protocols, again and again, not only showed that there was less lead in the water than there actually was, but they actually were, when they knew that there was lead, and they could see that there was lead, they kept sort of trying to find different tests to keep the lead down. So it was actually like there was a campaign within the DEQ to find ways to show that there was less lead in the water than there actually was.
And when you say the Department of DEQ, what do you mean?
I'm sorry, the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. And it's sort of, it's a local agency within Michigan that sort of mirrors the work that the EPA does in terms of looking at environmental issues and protecting the public and environmental issues, really.
What was their motivation in doing that? You said they employed faulty testing protocols. Aren't they scientists, too? Don't they have, I mean, what were the faulty protocols?
Well, for example, when you're testing for lead in water, one of the things that you don't want to do is you don't want to flush your pipes. Because that's going to obviously that's what you want to do in the morning when you're making coffee. If you think you've got lead pipes, you want to flush the pipes for 2 minutes, 5 minutes to make sure that there's any lead residue that's collected overnight is flushed in the system. Well, they were asking residents when they were doing testing to flush the pipes before the testing happens. Well, what that obviously does is it moves lead through the system, and you're testing and collecting less lead than there actually is there. That's one of the things they would do. Another thing that would happen was that the agencies would, again, they would find out that there was lead in the, they would find out when they're doing tests that there was lead, and then instead of reporting that lead, they would sort of go back and do other tests. They would just continue to sort of figure out how ways that they could show that there's less lead in the system. One of the things that they would do is they would throw out lead sampling or sites that were being sampled where lead was high, they would throw those sites out so they wouldn't be counted. So, for example, Leanne Walters, who is one of the critical hero figures in this story, mm-hmm. who really uncovers this, her lead testing in her home was extraordinarily high. But the MDEQ decided that site just was not going to be counted as a regular site. So there are lots of statistical ways in which they were sort of manipulating the science.
Yeah, and just to give people an idea of what we're talking about, when we say extraordinarily high, it was something like 104 parts per million in a toxin that is supposed to be closer to like 15 parts per million.
Right. Well, one of the tests came back 104 parts per billion.
I apologize. Yeah.
Billion.
Okay.
And yeah, per billion. And I think that the EPA safe levels is something like 5 or 15. I think it's between 5 and 15 parts per billion. So that's extraordinarily high. She had other tests that were even much higher, over 300 parts per billion. I think at one point there was a test that was I believe it's 13,000 parts per billion. So when you consider that hazardous waste is 5,000 parts per billion, that particular test, which we talk about in the film, was five times hazardous waste. So, you know, there's a point where, you know, you have to ask yourself, what is the motivation? What is actually happening that people are not recognizing these statistics?
Right. Well, what was the motivation? That's what they're supposed to do. Where did the breakdown occur? Do you know?
You know, I think that's a really hard question, and I'm not sure we've got to. I think that the breakdown occurs. I think the breakdown in this case occurred when the decision was made originally to switch water mm-hmm. to the Flint River. And when problems began to occur, the agencies began to see a reason to sort of protect themselves and insist that the choice that they made was really a smart and safe choice. And they did all kinds of things to sort of continue to do that. This is in my view, we don't talk about this soon, but in my view, this is one of the things that happens in many governmental agencies, bureaucracies. A decision is made, it becomes clear it's a bad decision, and rather than recognizing it's a bad decision, the culture of the agencies becomes one of just just creating other kinds of reasons why we should accept that decision.
You know, after
this was certainly happening.
After you know, covering this issue for months on end now, we've had several shows on it. I was, you know, you think, well, it can't happen again, but in the film that airs on Wednesday on PBS, it's clear that this actually has happened in the recent past in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so that was a critical sort of a learning experience for me in the film, to discover that there was actually in the early 2000s a lead exposure in Washington, D.C. through water, which actually was much more dangerous and affected many, many more people. People in Washington, D.C. were exposed to lead for over 3 years before it was acknowledged. The water utilities acknowledged that they were being exposed to lead at a hazardous level. And similarly, the parallels in the two situations are very interesting, because in both situations, the treatment plants did not include corrosion control treatment. And the corrosion control treatment would have allowed, would have protected the interior of the pipes so that they did not corrode and so that lead did not get in the system. This was the critical problem in Flint, and this is also happening in Washington, D.C. So I think part of the problem is not just agencies not, in some cases, doing their job, but we have a very fragile water infrastructure in this country. It's extremely fragile. There are a lot of lead pipes. There's a lot of work that's going to have to be done to protect the public. Otherwise, we're going to see these problems again and again.
Why can't they just return to the old ways of treating the water and keep the pipes the way they were before they switched from Lake Huron to the Flint River?
Well, they're going back. They've gone back to, you know, Lake Huron for now. So they've got a good, you know, water source.
Right.
By the way, the problem was really, in my view, the problem was not essentially the Flint River. There's a lot of reporting as the problem was really the Flint River. You know, you can treat hazardous waste and get drinkable, potable water. Mm-hmm. The problem was the actual treatment, that the facility was not prepared to treat the water, that they didn't have the experience. Treating a river is very complex because the water chemistry changes continually. Mm-hmm. So they were taking on a very challenging problem. To answer your question, I think that they have gone back to, yes, they have gone back to Lake Huron. The pipe, you know, interiors are being, are being healed, and so you've got the interior scales being redeveloped. And right now, many people who've been involved with this issue feel that the water is drinkable and is safe with a filter. I think one of the big problems here is that we talk about this in the film, mm-hmm. once the public trust is gone, you know, the public doesn't know who to trust. So even if people who are very authoritative and very expert and have done all the work that they can in terms of the science of presenting the evidence that this water is safe, people have been harmed so badly that many of them are not going to believe it, and they don't know who to believe. So the issue is not just a science issue. It's also an issue of trust, and it's also an issue of trauma.
Another issue is the Legionnaires' disease. There were, I think, two outbreaks that scientists are relating to the lead crisis in Flint. What's the connection there?
Well, I think there are three outbreaks, and I think that there are about 85 people were affected.
And 12 people died, right?
That's right. 12 or 12 deaths. The connection that people like Mark Edwards and also Amy Prude make is that when the pipes began to corrode because of the lack of corrosion control, that the iron rust began to interact with the chlorine in the water, which should have killed the Legionella bacteria. Mm-hmm. But what happened was the iron rust interacting with the chlorine became neutralized, and so there was nothing to attack the Legionella, and so the Legionella thrived. That's their theory, and there's a lot of evidence to support that. So this would be the first, as Amy Pruden says in the film, this is Dr. Amy Pruden from Virginia Tech. So this is the first incidence of Legionella developing because of a lack of corrosion control that's been identified. So the treatment of the water had everything to do with all of the different health and health threats and the outcomes in Flint.
The larger question, as you've mentioned, is what it means for the rest of us. Something like 1.2 million miles of lead pipe has been laid in some 3,000 cities across the country. And the point is made that much of it is reaching the end of its usable lifespan. What happens? Let's say its usable lifespan ends. What happens to the pipe? Is it disintegrating? Is it you can't develop that coating on the inside, that scaly coating to protect it? Or what do we mean by a lifespan with lead pipes?
You know, that's a good question. I'm not sure. You know, my understanding is that lead, one of the reasons that, you know, the Romans and many other people have used lead pipe is it's very durable and it will stick around for a while. So other parts of the infrastructure, the water infrastructure, may corrode and you know, have problems. I'm not sure the lead is actually going to go away. There's so many lead pipes, and the cost is going to be astronomical to replace them. And one of the other problems, too, is in most cities, water utilities have kept bad records. So trying to find out where the lead pipes are is even a challenge. It's a big problem in terms of, you know, keeping ourselves safe and keeping water safe. I mean, I always find it sort of striking that there's so many things that we want to support and pay money for, and then we think about to make our lives happier and more exciting. But fundamentally, if you don't have safe water, you know, the rest of it is sort of out the window. I mean, that's the future. That's our lives.
Yeah, the point is made that the lead crisis in Flint is another example of how science intersects with social justice.
Absolutely. I think it's not only an example of how science intersects with social justice, it's also a critical example of how citizens, you know, the role of citizens in sort of creating, you know, scientific information, scientific knowledge. You know, the citizens of Flint, especially Leanne Walters, are responsible for really exposing this problem. The other scientists like Mark Edwards, who came in later on, really showed how widespread the problem had become, and really undergird her research. But fundamentally, it was ordinary citizens who exposed the fact that water was not being treated properly, and that there was lead that was actually going into the system and affecting people. So it's pretty remarkable when you think of the work of this. This is work by ordinary. You know, this is scientific work being done by ordinary citizens.
It is. It's
who also doing testing.
Yeah, and you said that it started with her asking that fundamental question: how is water treated? I mean, just beginning at the beginning, and that's a classic, you know, approach to science.
Exactly. It's a, and this is a person who really was not trained. I think she was living at home working as a mother. She'd mm-hmm. been trained as a nurse. She was not trained in water science. She was not trained in water technologies. She just sort of dug into this and just really tried to find out really what actually is happening here. Why are my children affected so badly? Why are other people's children affected so badly? Why is my hair falling out? Why are all these things happening? And she just sort of just dug away at it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that one of the things we also try to point out is that, you know, and we've touched on this already, is that, you know, the science of, you know, science is absolutely critical if we're going to have a stable, healthy, you know, society or civilization. You know, we need to have well-funded scientific organizations that do the things that they're supposed to do to protect people and to put the truth out about what they know. And this was one of the failures in Flint. I think those agencies are doing a much better job now. But fundamentally, that was one of the failings, is that you had scientists who had information, not for whatever reason, political reasons or pressure from into whatever, they were not putting out what they knew, which was that the water was just simply not, it was just simply not safe.
Llewellyn Smith, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I hope you have a chance to watch the show.
Yes. Llewellyn Smith, he's the producer, writer, and director of NOVA, Poisoned Water. It premieres Wednesday, May 31st at 9 p.m. on WOSU-TV. For more about that, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More about lead, and especially lead in paint. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about lead. We just heard from the producer and director of a new NOVA program on the topic of the Flint lead pipe crisis. For more information about when the program airs on PBS, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Now we're going to pivot to another potential lead hazard in our home, that is lead paint, still a problem in especially older urban low-income rental properties. The amended state budget bill now pending in the Ohio Senate includes a provision that would strip cities of local control to address lead poisoning. The measure would end prevention programs in Toledo and Cleveland. State Representative Derek Marin, a Republican from Monclova Township in Northwest Ohio, introduced the amendment. He was invited to join the conversation but did not respond to our invitation. David Norris, a senior researcher at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State, helped write the Toledo Ordinance. He joins us now. Welcome, David Norris.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be here.
Also joining us is Executive Director of the Ohio Healthy Homes Network, Patricia Barnes. Welcome to the show, Patricia.
Thanks for having me.
David, tell us about the Toledo Ordinance. What does it do?
Well, the Toledo Ordinance, it's the result of about 4 years of work on the part of the Toledo Lead Poisoning Prevention Coalition and ABLE, Advocates for Basic Legal Equity in Toledo. And what the ordinance does basically is it requires the owners of rental properties, 1 to 4 unit rental properties, to have their properties inspected and have them certified lead safe before those properties are rented to families with children.
Why is that a problem? Is inspection expensive? Is it unreliable? What?
Well, the inspection itself is not terribly expensive.
Like, what are we talking about?
Well, for a lead wipe inspection, and the ordinance does require lead wipes, which means that you actually take a swipe of, you know, surfaces within the home, and then send those off for testing. That's on the order of, you know, less than $100. And depending on the results of that lead swipe test, you know, if there is a lead hazard identified in the home, then the ordinance requires, and we have to be really specific mm-hmm. about the terminology here, does not require lead abatement, which would be the entire, you know, complete removal of lead from the property, mm-hmm. because that can, you know, range in the thousands to tens of thousands of dollars, depending
right.
on the problem. It requires the implementation of interim measures. And interim measures include covering up the, you know, if there's a lead paint hazard, covering that over with paint, painting the surface. You can use the more durable, very thick, covering paint, or you can just use regular paint.
Like the primer paint or?
Well, there's a special paint that you can get to cover up, you know, lead paint. Mm-hmm. But you can also cover it with regular paint. Just requires, you know, more attention to maintaining the paint surface.
But that means that you have to keep testing.
That's correct. And in fact, the ordinance requires retesting every, I believe, 4 years. To recertify the property as lead safe. But interim measures also include things like, for example, if there is bare dirt under the drip line of the home.
What does that mean?
Well, that means that if you think about the eaves of your home,
okay.
And as rain drips off of the roof,
right.
Any lead that was in the atmosphere, when we had leaded gasoline or even currently, gets concentrated under that drip line where the water drips off of the roof. And if there's bare soil there, then a child who plays in that soil could become exposed, you know, and ingest lead dust. So, you know, you plant some vegetation if there's bare soil, you know, grass, bushes, whatever, just to discourage children from playing there and also to kind of lock in the soil so that it's not dusty. So those are the kind of
measures.
But
that could be anybody could have that kind of an issue.
That's correct.
Yeah. Why? But the ordinance only applies to people who rent.
Well, it applies to the owners of the rental properties specifically. And the reason it applies to rental properties is that there's commerce involved. Let me give you an example. Let's say you invite me over for dinner. And I'll come any day of the week. That's fine. But let's say you serve me a steak. When you brought the steak home from the store, you left it sitting out for a few hours. Or you serve me a baked potato with sour cream that you left sitting out overnight. If I get sick, the health department isn't going to come in and shut down your kitchen because they don't have jurisdiction there. There's no commerce involved.
Okay.
But if you have a restaurant and I come into your restaurant, and I get sick as a result of the food that you serve me, then there's a public interest involved. You're providing a product, and you should be providing a product that is safe. And the same argument applies here. If you are the owner of a rental property, then you should be providing a property that is safe for the people who rent it. And that's the intent of the ordinance.
Patricia Barnes, let's talk a little bit about what lead does and why in particular it's dangerous for children. What's that connection?
Well, lead is a neurotoxin. So it damages really all systems of the body, but particularly the nervous system, which includes your brain. So it can cause learning deficits, including loss of IQ. It can cause kidney failure.
Why are children more affected by it than adults?
Because they're growing so fast, and their body takes in lead just as if it was nutrients. And then it stores it in the bones. It can also cause anemia by affecting their production of red blood cells. And they don't have that blood-brain barrier yet, so everything affects them so much more than adults.
What do you mean by blood-brain barrier, that everything that's in your blood's
right, can go into
your brain?
Right. Right. And it affects also children who have not yet been born, who are in utero. So the younger the children, really, the more influence lead can have on their health.
So especially then we're concerned about children and pregnant women.
Yes. And the cutoff has been 6 years old, less than 6 years old. Lead levels peak around 2 years old. You see children becoming poisoned when they start a lot of hand-to-mouth behavior. They are putting things in their mouth, their hands, they're touching windowsills, they're on the floor where there may be lead dust. And lead dust is really invisible. The amount of lead it takes to poison a child, you could hardly see with your eyes. So it's mixed in with all the other dust you have in your house, as well as any paint that's chipping or peeling or chalking in your home. So you really, there's really no way to know for sure if you have hazards in your home unless you test.
State Representative Marin, who introduced the amendment and declined or did not respond to our invitation to be on the show today, said that the local ordinances like the one in Toledo and another one recently enacted in Cleveland, hasn't gone into effect yet, discriminate against a small minority of homeowners. Do you know what he means by that?
Well, it focuses on 1 to 4 unit rental properties. And the reason is that they looked at their data for risk assessments that were completed over the last 4 or 5 years, and all of the children were poisoned in 1 to 4 unit rental properties. So that's the focus of the ordinance. They are taking this step by step. So the first step is to look at the places where children are being poisoned the most, and then go on from there to maybe larger properties, maybe to home ownership, but not to try to take on the entire thing at one time.
David Norris, Representative Merritt says that the local ordinances are unconstitutional. Again, he's not here to talk about it himself, but do you know what he's talking about there?
Well, I'm not an authority on state constitutional law, so I can't say I can't address that specifically. I can say that in general, it's the state courts that determine constitutionality and not the legislature. I think the point that he's trying to make, and that he makes subsequently by saying that we're discriminating by only addressing the needs of some children, is that there's not a protection in place for children in private residences. And that's not true.
You mean in places their parents own or?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And that's not true. There is protection. It's not good protection, but there is protection. When you purchase a home, the seller of that home is required to disclose any known lead hazards.
I was going to ask you about that. Okay.
Yeah. Now, that word known is key here, because if you're not aware of a hazard in your home, then you don't have anything to disclose. It's a disincentive to ever look at whether there's any lead in your home or not. So, you know, there is a protection there, but it's inadequate. It's incomplete because that's voluntary. Now, the buyer of the home can request a lead inspection, but depending on what's found, you know, that could cause the seller to walk away, you know, look for somebody else who doesn't really care about lead. And, you know, there are people who may not care whether there's lead in their home or not, if they don't have children or whatever. So I think that's the point that he's trying to make.
This amendment to the state budget that's pending now in the Ohio Senate, it says it doesn't replace, it just stops the ordinances in their tracks and requires the state to do something, but it doesn't prescribe what the state should do, right?
Correct.
And I wondered, couldn't the state make laws more uniform and not rely on locals? Patricia?
Yes, and our organization's been working with Senator Peggy Lehner to create a lead study group, which would take about 18 months to look at the state lead law and improve it so it's more protective of children against lead. Right now, the way the legislation is written in the budget, it says only the Ohio Department of Health can regulate lead. And so It not only strikes down the Toledo lead law and what Cleveland's doing, it strikes down a body of law that's been in place for probably 30 or 40 years.
Such, you mean that where locals have been doing this?
Including here in Columbus. They have permissive authority to inspect rental units for lead.
What does that mean, permissive authority?
They're not using it. They only go in when a child's poisoned, which is okay. They're following the state law. The state law is really inadequate because it reacts to children. It does not prevent lead poisoning from occurring. So that's why we want this lead study group. And we hope that they would refer the issue of local versus state laws to this group. And it's going to have a balanced group of people from different parts of the industry.
Yeah.
Well, I would also point out, though, that and I think the study group is a great idea. I think this does need to, you know, to be studied further. But that's 18 more months when we're going to have kids continuing to be lead poisoned if preemption goes through, if this thing stays in the budget. And that's just not acceptable. I mean,
because once a kid is poisoned, the lead never goes away, right?
You can remove the lead from the child's body. It's okay. A painful process called chelation. But once the damage that lead does is done, there's no reversing that.
I think it's really fascinating on the NOVA program, which airs on Wednesday. They showed what the synapses in the brain are doing when they're kind of communicating with each other, and that calcium is a big part of that process, and that the brain attracts the lead to it the same way it attracts calcium to it, and that where the calcium, you know, aids in that process, lead inhibits and deadens that process.
That's correct.
And that you can never get that synapses back again. Once it's dead, it's dead.
Once the synapse is damaged, it's damaged. Yes.
Although I would add that if you can reach children early after they've had a positive lead test.
Where they're still growing and developing.
Yes, you can reach them with early childhood education, developmental assessments. You begin to work with them on this learning, potential learning disability, so they can work around it just like other children with learning disabilities can work around those.
You know, we've been spent the last segment talking about the Flint water crisis. Is this something that triggered any interest in you, Patricia Barnes, when the Flint story came out? I mean, I know I immediately got somebody on from the city to talk about how they treat the water.
Yes, we're very concerned. Lead from water is not the main reason why children are getting poisoned in Ohio, but it contributes to the low blood lead levels we have in the state.
The low.
So what we've learned through research over the last decade or so is that very low levels of lead in blood, so even less than 10 micrograms per deciliter. So the state followed the CDC's recommendation, lowered the lead level to 5. But they also said there's no safe level of lead in blood. So we have a lot of children in Ohio testing between 5 and 9. And then underneath 5, they don't record the level because it's very hard to measure right now. But even levels below 5 are not thought to be safe. So the lead from the water is a contributor to those very low lead levels. And they've had documentation that those children experience loss of IQ points because of low blood lead levels like that.
The point is made that the lead crisis in Flint is another example of how science intersects with social justice issues. You've made a similar point, David Norris. The lead problem disproportionately impacts certain people. How so and who?
Well, the lead poisoning is disproportionately affecting African-American families, African-American children, children of color, Latino children, because those are the folks who tend to live in lower-income housing in our city centers. And those are the homes that are both older and more than likely haven't had the proper maintenance to, you know, remove lead from the home or at least address lead issues in the homes. And so disproportionately we see, you know, folks living in that housing, and we also see disproportionately those folks, children, represented in the lead testing data.
And when we talk about this small minority of property owners that are affected by, say, the issue in Toledo, how many are we talking about? How many do you know how many units or how many properties are affected by this? How many people own the property?
There are different estimates about that. It's difficult to pin down rental properties if there isn't a rental registry, and that's the case in Toledo. We don't have a registry of rental properties. And so what the health department is attempting to do now, and I haven't seen their latest estimates, but they're comparing tax mailing records and water bill records with their parcel data, trying to tease out of that which properties are most likely rental properties. So I can't give you a specific number. I can say that, you know, based on our mapping analysis, essentially the entire central city of Toledo is, you know, lower valued and older housing. And so it would fall, if it's rental property, it would fall under this ordinance.
We are talking about lead in the water when it comes to Flint, lead in the paint in older homes when it comes to particularly Columbus in the state of Ohio. It's a big issue. We'll talk about that more coming up. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The amended state budget bill now pending in the Ohio Senate includes a provision that would strip cities of local control to address lead poisoning. The measure would end prevention programs in Toledo and Cleveland. State Representative Derek Marin, a Republican from Monclova Township in Northwest Ohio, introduced the amendment. He was invited to join the conversation but did not respond. Still with us is David Norris, senior researcher at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State. He helped write the Toledo Ordinance, and the Executive Director of the Ohio Healthy Homes Network, Patricia Barnes. Joining us now by phone is a professor at the University of Rochester Medical Center who studies lead health policies, Katrina Korfmacher. Welcome to the show.
Glad to be with you.
Your research has looked at local lead poisoning laws. What did you find?
Well, we've looked at local models in several different cities that have been passed in the past 10 or 20 years or so. And what we found was there's a lot of diversity in how this problem is approached. So each city took a very different approach to how to identify hazards, how to treat them, how to implement their laws. So that was the basic finding we had, is that each city had come to a different conclusion about what worked best for its community.
Is that necessarily a bad thing or what?
Actually, I think it's a really good thing because it reflects the fact that the lead problem is different everywhere. So lead affects every child's brain the same way. But lead is a health problem with a housing solution, and the interactions between housing markets and how many are rented and how they're supported and the age and condition of housing, those differ from place to place. Additionally, all of the programs that we found were successful really were based on a very strong local partnership between health agencies and housing, between community and government, between educators and housing specialists. And those kinds of connections really are locally unique. So that's why each of these communities had come to a different conclusion about what was going to work best for them.
So a plan like in Ohio that's in the state, pending in the state budget right now, which you know, could be signed into law by the end of the month, by the end of June. State-run programs, state uniformity isn't necessarily a good thing.
Not necessarily. And additionally, it, as I said, to really effectively combat lead poisoning, to prevent it at the source, which is housing, you really need a strong partnership between community groups, between housing agencies, and between health agencies. And that's not, you know, having that dominated by the state health department just doesn't make it possible to have to really take advantage of those partnerships and the potential they introduce for efficiencies, cost efficiencies, targeting risks effectively, and adapting over time to make sure that implementation is effective.
Who tends to oppose local ordinances when it comes to lead abatement and this kind of stuff?
Well, most of these ordinances are targeted at rental housing, so not surprisingly, it's the owners and managers of rental housing who are afraid of what this is going to do to their business models.
At one time, Rochester had a very high rate of lead poisoning among children. How did local policy – well, what tell us about the issue there and what local policy did to change that?
Sure. Well, in the early 2000s, we had over 10 to 20 times the national rate of children with elevated blood lead levels. And in certain neighborhoods, it was over 40% of kids. And that really caught the attention of educators, of people who were trying to work with these children with their learning and behavioral problems, and said, this is just not acceptable. So a very broad-based coalition of people came together and figured out an approach for Rochester, which involved targeting rental housing, but a partnership between the local health department and the local inspection agencies to really efficiently identify the houses that needed to be repaired, figure out the most cost-effective way to do that, educate and work with property owners to help them do that, provide some support in training, especially in the early years, and make sure that was implemented consistently over time. And as a result of that law, but even more so that partnership that supports it, our rate of lead poisoning has come down 2.5 times faster than any other community in upstate New York.
Lindsay in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi there.
Go ahead. Are you there?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes.
You're on the air. Go ahead.
I actually was calling because I wanted to make a comment about the fact that earlier they were talking about lead poisoning being more of an issue in, like, low-income African-American communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I just feel like saying that might hinder other parents in other communities from doing further testing on their own children or their own home
okay.
and their soil in their yards.
Right.
And
yeah, David Norris is nodding. Yeah, you get that, what she's getting at, David?
Yeah, I think it's important to point out that the risk is in older housing, and it also is in lower value housing. But if you live in a home that was built before 1978, and especially if you live in a home that was built before 1950, regardless of your income level, regardless of your socioeconomic status, regardless of the value of the home, there's the potential for there being lead paint. And so actually, you know, one of the problems that people might encounter, even if you're, you know, in a higher socioeconomic bracket, is when you start to do renovations to your home. If those aren't done properly with, you know, taking care to observe safe lead practices when you do the renovations, you could, and in fact, you know, children have been exposed to lead during home renovations if they aren't done properly.
Hmm. Okay, Lindsay, good point. You know, Katrina Korfmacher, I think Lindsay brings up a really interesting point that when sometimes people just think, you know, it's not my problem. I don't live in a low income neighborhood. Did you encounter that kind of issue in Rochester?
Well, we certainly had people wondering about the difference between owner-occupied housing and rental housing, mm-hmm. As you discussed earlier. And it's important to note that our lead law does say that if owner-occupants want their home to get inspected, the city will inspect it as well, but then they are also required to fix it up to protect their children. But all of these programs are really part of the benefit of working at the local level is you can use local data to design and target them really efficiently. And in the cities that we're talking about, there's good data showing that most of the kids who end up with lead poisoning are in older rental housing in poor condition. And as Patricia Barnes said, that's why these programs are trying to target and start with that housing first.
Lindsay, thanks a lot for that call. The state budget proposed by Governor Kasich included a provision to fund a new voluntary lead-safe housing registry. The city of Columbus wants a list of unsafe housing as well. How do other cities help prospective renters make an informed choice? Patricia Barnes?
Well, many cities in Ohio have HUD lead grants, and one of the requirements of the grants is to keep a list of properties that have been made lead-safe. Some of them put it on their websites. Others, you have to ask them for the list. I believe Cleveland has a lead-safe housing registry on the books, but it's never been enforced.
Does that mean? I mean,
well, originally, I'm not sure how long ago this was, but they passed a law saying that owners had to be a part of this lead-safe housing registry, but there was never any enforcement put behind it, so it was sort of a law that never went into effect.
So when we looked at that particular law and saw the provision for a voluntary lead registry, it made a lot of sense that owners could voluntarily make their home lead safe and then have it listed as a lead safe property. Mm-hmm. But over time, only a handful of owners had taken advantage of that. So clearly the cost and incentives weren't set up to make that an attractive option for property owners. And if we stay focused on what we want to do, which is protecting as many children as possible, having just a handful of people participate doesn't suggest that that's a real effective solution.
Yeah, David?
Well, and this goes back to the point we made earlier about lead disclosure when you sell a property.
Yeah.
A voluntary registry is fine if people participate, but in order to participate and, you know, be on that registry, you have to do the inspection, and, you know, there just isn't an incentive to do that.
Hmm. Yeah, Patricia?
The state of Ohio Department of Health is going to fund that lead registry with funds from Medicaid and also provide some funds for lead abatement, $5 million a year. So the two projects are tied together. So,
David, you were shaking your head there.
What, $5 million a year for lead abatement is
a drop in the bucket.
Paltry.
The state Department of Health is going to target a list of properties on their website which have been, they have lead orders that have not been satisfied, and they have been ordered vacant and placarded. So that's going to be the focus of the first $10 million. We are hoping, though, that they can get to some preventative work with those funds.
And Katrina Korfmacher, people want to fix their houses, but they're worried if there is lead, they won't be able to afford to do what needs to be done in them. Was there any help in Rochester, particularly for low-income people, to fix things?
So we're really lucky here that our city and our county have both put in the effort to develop strong HUD lead hazard control grant programs, and over $30 million in those grant programs have come into the community over time. But as David said earlier, those programs are generally for full abatement. You can't do a lot of units for that amount of money. So while they're useful for targeting and helping owner-occupants and targeting some of the highest-risk housing, we knew it was only going to touch a fraction of the houses that need to be made lead safe. So our law, which is quite similar to the Toledo model, raises the floor for lead safety and says you need to use interim controls to make sure that a unit is lead safe. And we found that approach is extremely cost-effective and affordable for property owners. In fact, many of the property owners found that they could meet that standard without investing very much money at all, and have found it over time to be quite feasible to comply.
In Ohio, you mentioned there's a registry of houses with lead hazards, and Columbus has more properties, 51, on the registry than any other Ohio city. That's according to the Columbus Dispatch. And children are living in 10 of those houses, or were. What are Columbus's local ordinances when it comes to the issue of lead paint? I mean, how can children actually be known to be living in these houses? Patricia Barnes?
I don't believe people knew that they were living in the homes. The homes had been ordered vacant. Obviously, some of the owners re-rented those homes or sold them. We don't have good disclosure about lead orders in Ohio, so they're not attached to the property titles, for example. And an owner can tear off the placard and re-rent the property, and if the city isn't looking, they can get by with this for some time. This is happening all over the state. And I believe now there's going to be stepped up review of those properties in various cities around the state. They're going to go and visit those properties regularly to make sure that they're not occupied.
You know, Katrina Korfmacher, when I talk here about that lead's been identified, the house has been sold without disclosure, or it's been rented again, that sounds criminal to me. Is there at any point in Rochester where there's been a tipping point on that?
Well, we did look to see if there were properties that, we called them repeat offender properties. And in many cities, we found that to be the case. Not so much here. But that is certainly one way that many cities have found to be a useful targeting strategy, is to look and see what are the worst of the worst and try to invest the resources there to either take them off the market permanently or get them fully abated, and certainly to make sure that people are aware of those hazards. But as I said, all of this housing has the potential for lead hazards, so we really want to make sure that all of them have, when they are remodeled, are done safely, and they are maintained in a lead-safe condition to protect all the kids who are living there, partly because we don't want to set up incentives for discrimination against families with children and making sure they have as much choice as possible of where to live.
Hmm. And what do you think, Katrina, are the best types of outreach in educating the public about the dangers of lead?
That's a great question. We've been really fortunate here because our education community really stood up and said, this is a problem for us, that we see kids coming into school who have so many challenges, and this is one that we can prevent. And it's really heartbreaking to see when kids are damaged by lead and they can't control their behavior and they can't learn, and that sets them up for a lifetime of challenges in terms of education, employment, and health. It was really our education community that I think was really effective in helping people understand that this was a problem of not only children's well-being, but our whole future's well-being, our whole community's future.
Katrina Korfmacher, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
It's Katrina Korfmacher. She's a professor at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Also, Patricia Barnes, executive director of the Ohio Healthy Homes Network. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And David Norris, senior researcher at the Kerwin Institute at OSU. Thanks to you.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks to everybody for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.